How's everybody doing? We can at least get introduced, right? My name is Dustin Campbell. I am a principal software engineer at Microsoft. I work on the C-sharp team. I spend 4 hours every week in C-sharp language design meetings as I'm part of the language design team. I also spend a lot of time just working on cross-platform editing experiences, right? So Visual Studio, Visual Studio for Mac. I'm kind of the person running the C-sharp for VS Code project right now. So I am immersed in C-sharp. On Twitter, I guess I was known at Build as the other guy because Mads Torgersen, who's the C-sharp primary C-sharp language designer, and I always do this talk at Build called The Future of C-sharp, and the tweets were like, hey, look at Mads and the other guy. So you guys got the other guy. I'm sorry about that. But we're here to talk about C-sharp 7, we're going to spend some time in slides, but I promise we will not be there long. Just kind of an update I want to give on kind of C-sharp and how we think about it and where we feel like we're at. We always like to look at this, the Stack Overflow developer surveys each year, and they've got some interesting data in there. And again, this year, we're on the list of the most popular languages, which by Stack Overflow turns out really the most used languages and widely used languages. And we're up there with good company. We came in at number 4, which is great. There's 3 above that and 3 languages above that. Well, actually, one of those is not really a language, but that's okay. And we're in good shape. I'll leave it vague. You guys decide which I meant. But also looking over at Stack Overflow's most loved technologies. This is a place we like to be because this is really trying to distill. They say most loved, but it's kind of a weird title. What this really is drilling down into in the survey is that, hey, what are the languages or the technologies that you're using right now that you don't want to stop using, that you're continuing to use and you're enjoying it, and you want it? So they kind of turn that into most loved. And we're on there as well, and that feels pretty good. It feels good to be on both lists. There are actually only 3 languages that are on both lists this year. C#, TypeScript, and also Python. So we're in good company there as well, which is great. So let's talk a little bit about .NET languages. There's 3 particular languages in the .NET space that we kind of put a lot of kind of weight behind. That's C#, Visual Basic, and F#. There are others out there, but these are just the ones that we spend most of our investments in. Now, when I look at C#, this is kind of a fuzzy look at the populations. We see millions of people using C# today, and we see them using it in a broad array of domains, right? It's places in many cases didn't even dream of it being, in game development and on mobile devices and everywhere. And so we want to make sure that, because of that, we want to make sure that our investments in C# are in keeping this language evolved, relevant. We want it to be that language you pick up and say, oh yeah, the next project I start, that's going to be in C#. We want that, we want to continue to evolve C# and invest in it such that that's how you guys feel about it as well. Now, Visual Basic. Visual Basic is still seeing a lot of active use. There's hundreds of thousands of Visual Basic developers out there, and there's a lot of lovers of Visual Basic. There's a lot of derision of Visual Basic as well, but to be honest, there's always been derision of Visual Basic since Visual Basic 1, right? So that kind of goes with the territory. Now, by and large, we see that the domains that that Visual Basic developers tend to target with several exceptions. But by and large, tend to be kind of more homogenous than C#, kind of in more of a line of business apps and that sort of thing. And so kind of where we want to make investments in Visual Basic is really making sure that when we involve the language or we invest in tooling, we want to really make it great for those domains, right? And continue to make it great for the things that Visual Basic is being used for. And also when the framework evolves, right, and adds something new that Visual Basic needs to consume and declare, like for example with the new introduction of tuples in C# 7, we want to make sure there's a great story for that in Visual Basic as well. We don't want to leave Visual Basic developers behind using APIs that now feel kind of clunky and weird. They need to feel natural in the language, right? And so those are the kinds of investments we're making there. And then finally, there's F#. And F# has gone kind of gangbusters over the last few years. It's been amazing to watch. While there's tens of thousands of users in this kind of space of active development, by and large, it's it pervades kind of all the domains that I mentioned for C#, which is kind of amazing, right? It's, you know, it's everywhere. F# code is literally running everywhere. But also they have, the F# language has probably the most vibrant community I've ever seen around a language. It's incredible, right? Per capita, it's amazing how many of the F# how many developers in the F# community give back into F#, you know, pull requests into tooling, building out, you know, an entire package management system for F# with Packet and all of these sorts of things. It's amazing how much is done there. And so our investments in F# is kind of to get out of the way of that a little bit, right, and make sure that we're not an impedance to that, that we don't impede that at all. We want to make sure that that if there are blockers to adoption or blockers to the community making those changes, pushing the language and the tooling forward, we want to make sure that we provide whatever infrastructure is needed. Okay, and so that's what we've been doing a lot lately. Actually, one of the guys in the F# team, he comes to stand up every morning at Microsoft, and he's like, and I'm like, so what'd you do this week? He's like, I merged 20 pull requests from other people. I was like, didn't you write any code? He's like, no, I just merge pull requests now. That's what I do. That's just because of kind of the activity and the involvement by the community. So that's a pretty awesome place to be. It's actually pretty inspirational to us in other languages as well to look at and kind of have something to that we would deeply like to have, right? All right. So C#. Let's talk about C#. We've got several minutes to talk about C#. First of all, we just shipped C# 7.0. 7.0 in March with Visual Studio 2017. I recommend you use it. It is great. It is one better than last time. And if you can't use it at work, I mean, use it at home. It's really delightful to use. We'll talk about, you know, some of the features in there in a little bit. But what's on the horizon is C# 7.1. We're going to introduce point releases into the language. Technically not introducing point releases. It's a little known fact that there's already been a point release of C#. For all of you guys with my gray hair might remember that back when we did .NET Framework 1.0, and then shortly after that was .NET Framework 1.1, which was a minor release, we actually shipped C# 1.2 with that release, which is it's actually very hard to find the C# 1.0 compiler anymore. It's always the 1.2 compiler. With this release, we want to do kind of small features with 7.1, little things to kind of take existing features in the language and just make them kind of feel a little bit better, a little bit more, a little natural, just very small features, the sorts of things we wouldn't do in a major release. Because what happens when you're pushing a major release of a product is that all the little things kind of fall off the schedule as you're trying to get the big things out, right? And so having these point releases kind of gives us a forcing function to build some of those into the language. The delivery mechanism for this, actually, at Build, we gave out preview bits of the next update to Visual Studio 2017. That actually includes C# 7.1, at least pieces of it. Again, you know, software engineering, we understand we're just like everybody else, and it turns out that only half of C# 1 is in there, 7.1 is in there, because, we missed the date to merge and snap, and that was, you know, it happens. We got it in the date and in the next day. So I'm going to show some features from that as well. Okay, so we've got some things there. So demos. C# 7.2 is something we're looking at. And this, I want to be real clear. What we're doing with this is don't go like building engineering schedules around this, right? What we're trying to do here with kind of these plans is kind of to state our intentions about here's the things we want to do in these places, right? The language design process is largely frustrating in a lot of ways. It's fun, it's satisfying. It can be very frustrating when, you know, things you plan for and you go, you know what, that feature doesn't really matter, cut, right? It turns out we spent a bunch of time going down some design road and find that it actually doesn't hold together and compose with the rest of the language. And that happens more often than you might think. So with these, I want to just be real clear. These are just putting some labels on intentions around a ship kind of vehicle for the language and what might go in it, right? Okay, so just I'm trying to use very loose words there. But the idea here are features for C# 7.2 are features around safe, efficient, kind of low-level managed code, right? So the things, a lot of things that unsafe code is used for today, to try and find ways to do that in more in safe ways. Try and push kind of unsafe back to being a corner of the language where it should be as an escape hatch. There are a lot of scenarios now where people are trying to write very, very efficient code that allocates far less garbage, and so you're not dealing with nearly as many garbage collections. Like, you know, doing for example, the Unity guys are very, very interested in this. The sorts of things that might go at the very lowest levels of you know, Kestrel or SignalR, the foundations of kind of ASP.NET, those sorts of places. And so that's what we're looking at for C# 7.2. C# 7.3 may not happen. Yeah, we'll see. It all depends on, you know, larger business goals and what ship vehicles we have, right? But the idea here, it's just kind of in our minds that the pattern matching feature that's in C# 7, I'm going to show in a bit, that, you know, we can take that much further, and this would be maybe the place where we start doing next steps there. And then, yes, there's going to be another major release of C#. We do have a future of C#. That's good. This is where we kind of do our big major features and kind of our big, where we do a lot of thinking, things that require framework changes or runtime changes, where we kind of need an inflection point where we can just kind of get everything in at once. That's where we think of these major releases. And so, and we're, you know, because we're doing point releases and major releases kind of side by side right now at the same time, I've got some prototypes to show. So, that'll be fun. Okay, let's get out of slides. You're tired of it. Now, let's talk about C# 7. So, first, I'm just gonna build up a program, and we're gonna try and use some C# 7 features along the way. It's just gonna be, it's demo fodder code. This is not brilliant stuff. But let's say I've got an array of numbers, okay? And we'll make them, say, like the powers of 2. That's 4, 8, 16, 32. Everybody's got these memorized, right? All right. Now, you know, the problem is, I mean, I'm sure we can take these out a long ways, and I know many of you know them more than I do. But I'm not all that smart, and I can come in and I can decide, you know what, I can use binary literals, right? That's a new thing in C# 6, the ability to do a binary literal. This is actually probably in the product you're using if you haven't used it yet. Now, I press Control Dot and I brought up the light bulb, and that shows a refactoring. This is actually a customer contribution that he's just like, you know, I really want to be able to convert between decimals and hexadecimal and binary. I said, sure, you know, submit a pull request. And so he did. And so we can change these very quickly into binary literals. And then, of course, now, though, when they become binary literals, you know, they become kind of long, right? It's not as readable. You can clearly see their powers of 2, but, you know, they become kind of long. So we could also separate those with digit separators, right? And again, I'll use the refactoring that's available to separate them into nibbles, which is the absolute cutest word for talking about the 4 bits that make up a byte, right? The 2 groups of 4 bits. And we can separate these guys. And these are features, I mean, these are features that are in C# 6, right? But they're kind of nice little features. Now, we're going to take these numbers, and I want to tally them up, okay? So that means, you know, I want to sum them, but I also want to count the numbers as I'm going, right? So we're going to do that here. We're going to create a method called tally, and we're going to pass in numbers. And I'm going to use, again, refactoring to generate that method. Let's see, we should give this, I'm going to call this values here. We can get rid of the static keyword because I hate that. Or the private keyword, I hate that. But now we're kind of at a place where, what do I want to return, right? Because I'm returning sum and count, returning 2 things. And that's kind of awkward, right, in a .NET framework. I could use out parameters. That's always fun. It makes calling code look great. I was being sarcastic. It's totally not true, right? I could also, I could create a class to hold them up, to hold these 2 values. I could use a .NET framework tuple type, right? But then it's just kind of awkward. Well, in C# 7, we can just use the values and just say, use a tuple, where it says just pack these two variables up into one kind of group of data, right? Just like a little bag of data is like how I like to think about it. Now, I'm getting a red squiggle on that because system.valueTuple is not in the .NET framework. There's a .NET framework console application. It's not there yet. It will be eventually. And until then, there's a NuGet package, okay? Now, I have turned on a feature in Visual Studio that I recommend you turn on. It causes us to do a little bit more work in the editor, but I think the value is just enormous. At the very top up here, and this is in the text editor C# advanced options page, there are a couple of options for suggesting usings in types that are in reference assemblies or in NuGet packages. And so this will now offer me up a light bulb along with that says, hey, you need to install a system.valueTuple package. And then it goes and installs that. We see that the internet works, and I'm good to go. It actually had the packages config and did the whole thing for me. If you're in different kinds of, if you're in a .NET Core project, it'll do this differently. It'll add it as a package reference in the project file like it's supposed to do. So that's kind of cool. Now, we should go ahead and, this is kind of a bad thing to return here. So we'll return like just kind of a default tuple. All right, and looks like that. It kind of looks a little weird, right? You know, the problem is that you know when you declare a tuple, when you have a tuple type, it has parentheses, and then the default expression also has parentheses. You wind up a lot of times with tuples. It looks a little strange when you have to deal with these sorts of things. It's fairly rare you have to state the type in some other expression, like in a cast expression, for example. You actually have to double up the parentheses, and it looks a little weird to me as well. You know, I kind of hate it. I'm going to just get rid of it. And this is actually another new language of C# 7. This is a new language feature in C# 7.1. We had default expressions for a long time in the language since 1.0, right? Since 2.0. And they've always been kind of clunky in the sense that, and redundant, where you say, okay, I've got this type over here, and I need to state it again in the default expression. Wouldn't it be great if we could just type infer that, if we could just look at the target type and say, I know what type you meant there, and do it for you? Now, I've got a red squiggle. That's not because I'm not using super hot bits. I am using super hot bits, and I have this feature working, but because with point releases, there becomes a concern, especially as we're shipping them kind of out of band or in Visual Studio updates, it becomes more of a concern when you're working on a team where people have different updates installed. You don't want to accidentally slip in C# 7.1 if you're like standardizing on C# 7 and waiting for major releases. And so by default, these do not light up. I actually have to specify in my project that I want to use a newer language version. And to make it easier, again, we offer a light bulb. So I can upgrade this project I can say I want to use the latest version of C#. I want to use 7.1, and I can upgrade everything if I want to. And so upgrading that sets the right property in the project, and I'm ready to go, and now this project is ready for C# 7.1. Okay? All right. Or we could just do this as well and declare it as a tuple literal. So now that we've got that, we can go up here, and we can see how we can use this thing. So I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to write this to the console. I'm going to write the sum. And the sum is probably going to be in the first item. So when I dot in, you see in IntelliSense, it's got item 1, item 2. It's kind of like system.tuple. That's not great. Actually, let's do this with an interpolated string so I know I'm doing the sum. C# 6 feature. Okay. All right, so it's kind of unfortunate that you have this item 1, item 2, because that kind of loses a lot of meaning, right? If these are bags of values, I kind of want to know what those values actually are, what my intention is for those values. And so you can do that with tuples. You can just add names, right? They end up kind of looking like parameter lists, and that's sort of kind of how you could think of them conceptually. It's like when I have parameters coming into a method, those names are about stating my intention for what those values that are going to come into the method are, and it's the same thing. I'm going to state my intention for the values that are coming out. Okay, and so now I've got names on these, and those will flow through to the method on the outside. So if I press IntelliSense, I'll get these names instead of item one, item two. Item one and item two are still there. You can still use them. You just don't need to, right? You can use the names that are good names for this. Now, I'm going to go ahead and give this a body because we're going to start trying to implement this. I'm going to extract a local to do that. We'll call this R. And again, I'm just using control dot. You can also use alt enter in 2017 to bring up the light bulb as a kind of a standard keystroke. So in here, so we've got these we've got this tuple literal. I can give it names in here as well. So I could give it like, you know, S and C, for example, for sum and count, just kind of shorthand. Again, if I'm thinking of these as just little packages, little kind of nuggets of variables, it makes a lot of sense to do so. Now, there's kind of an unfortunate thing with tuples, though, in that when you want to give them names, I find that I'm often flowing through my values and through my program, and I'm already giving them all good names, right? And so then when I put them in a tuple, I want to use the same names. And so then I'm kind of forced to write things kind of in a goofy way. So you end up having to write like, okay, I want to put values in here. Well, I'm going to have to give the name values. And then I kind of want to, like, let's say we want to put, say, R in here, you know, here's one that I just want to give a name. But I have to kind of restate things again. That's just kind of the way it is in C# 7. I'm super sorry about that. I apologize. It's actually partly my fault. But we're making it better. And so in C# 7.1, like I said, these are little features to make things a little bit nicer, to make existing language features just kind of feel a little bit better and kind of clean up some of the rough edges. I can just remove these, and we'll infer those names from the variables that are passed in. So if I hover over T, you can see that, hold on, whoa, hey, Zoom, it's not going to work well. So if I hover over T, if you look very carefully, you can see that they still have the names, values, R is in there, all those names are picked up from the variables that were passed in. So it'll just pick up and use the variable names, local variable names, field names, whatever you passed into the tuple, it'll just use those as the element names, which is super useful. So then you can kind of make sure things are in good shape. So I can come up here. Now, if you look carefully, there's a little, what Scott Hunter calls this the smudge. It's right there. It's very kind of hard to see, and I'm having trouble zooming. But the there's little dots underneath the I and the T, and that's a suggestion. Okay, this is something we're introducing into C# 2017. Different from an error or a warning, but it's something we want to tell you about. Okay, but try and do it a little less obtrusively than a squiggle, and certainly you don't want to break your build on it. If you happen to have, like, say, warnings turn as errors, and those settings already set. So this is telling me that actually I can use the explicit name here because I've used item one and it was given a name that was passed in and flowed through already. So we can go ahead and just use that there. All right. Now, let's actually go and implement Tally. And let me take a temperature. How are you guys enjoying this? Is this okay? Is it cool? I mean, these are cool features. I'm like, I don't know. You guys, it's early or something, but I'm pretty excited about these features. So let's go implement Tally. So I'm going to for each over our values. And then let's go ahead, these are tuples. We'll go ahead and essentially we'll just kind of reassign R here with new values. So let's say R.S+V and to add it up, and then R.C+1 to kind of do the count. And so you might be asking yourselves right now, is this allocating? Is this like an allocation nightmare? Are we doing a whole bunch of heap allocations or something like that because we're reassigning things? And the answer is no, it's actually super efficient. Tuples in C# are value types, they're structs. Right, we're not having to deal with what you have with system.tuple that's in the framework today is a class, right? And so you'd be heap allocating every time, it's actually very, very efficient. And even more interestingly, they're actually mutable structs. So I could also, I don't have to reassign things. I could just treat them as variables and do like this. Right. Because they're mutable. They are exactly what we've always told you not to do, right? Create structs with public mutable fields in them. Because That's, I don't know why they cause problems, right? And they trick you into situations. But in this case, we felt like this was the best solution, and it felt mostly in the vein of C sharp, where it's like, okay, if these are just variables hanging together, then they should act like C sharp variables all the time. They should be mutable. And you might ask, well, doesn't that cause problems with my, you know, with threading and multi-threading and that sort of thing? Well, because they're not immutable. I mean, we hear that all the time. Immutable data, use that so that you're not having to take locks and those sorts of things. No, because they're value types, right? So they're getting copied every time. So they work really well as keys in dictionaries where you want to have multiple values for a key and that sort of thing. So they're just beautiful for that. In fact, you can use them in generic types with no problem. I could create a dictionary with a key that was like, you know, int ID and string customer to, let's say name to a customer, right? And I could easily create this generic type. Let's go ahead and generate customer down here. And you can see that if I hover over it, you'll see that indeed T key is a tuple, int ID to string name. And those, again, those names kind of hang in there where we're under the hood. We've got attributes we're generating in various places so that we can pull those names out when we need to. Also means that older programs, C-sharp 6 programs, can still use C-sharp 7 tuples. They don't look as nice, but the type will still work, right? Because you can still access item 1 and item 2. You might not, it doesn't know how to pull out the names. The compiler doesn't know how to pull out those attributes and digest that, but you get the experience. You can still use them. All right. So one other thing about tuples that it kind of fixed another problem with the language, with async. How many people are using async? Great. I mean, it's a beautiful language feature. It does a lot of great things. We're kind of one of the forerunners with async, and now it's kind of everywhere and prevalent. So I'm expecting that some people that raise their hands and said, I'm using async, are like using TypeScript and stuff too, right? Because it's showing up in a lot of languages as a feature that is kind of a must-have in today's world. So, but one of the problems with async, or one of the small problems with async, is that you can't use out variables, right? So you find yourself having to package up data. If I wanted to return two values from that, well, I can't because I need a task to wrap around them, right, so that I can wait on those results. Well, with tuples, that becomes a lot easier, right? So I can create a task that returns a tuple without a problem. Okay, and we're in good shape. Oh, there's a, yeah, so this, I need to await this, of course, sorry. All right, and now, oh man, there's another error. Well, that's unfortunate. And we hear about this error a lot, because what's happened is I'm down in the main function of my program, and at that point, async stops being available to me, right? That you can't make the main function in a program async, right? And usually as people are getting started with async, there are lots of use cases for doing this. There's programs to build that do this, but often it's the unfortunate part is when you start experimenting with async and you're going through some tutorial and you're like, okay, I'll start this off in a console app, and then you get to like, you know, well, I can't make main async, so now you have to learn all about, you know, tasks and maybe start, you know, a task factory, and it's like, oh, the complexity just went through the roof, and it's pretty unfortunate. And so we decided to fix that, and so in C Sharp 7.1, I can do that. Nice. Again, it's just a nice little fix to an existing language feature. You know, essentially, we just generate the call to call getAwaiter, and then wait on that result, and it's good. So let's see a couple other things with async. This one is actually a C Sharp 7 feature, and it's one we haven't talked about an awful lot. But it's the notion of what we call task likes. In async, you know, we've got this type called task that has a very distinct shape, a very distinct pattern to it, to how it works. And so in C Sharp 7, we wanted to go and generalize that pattern, right? So the compiler, instead of thinking very strongly about tasks, it thinks about things that look like the shape of a task, right? So that you can go and write your own. If you if you're John Skeet. I'm pretty sure he's the only guy that's going to do this. But we've also written a couple. The most important one that's in this release is value task. And the idea here, oops, and again, I can add a package to get that in there. The idea here is to have a task that you can use, that you can wait on, some future result that doesn't allocate memory to do so, right, or allocates far less than a regular task does. Okay, so that's in C# 7 as well. You know, while we're in here, kind of want to show another IDE feature, because I'm kind of an IDE guy. I'm going to go ahead and add cancellation to this method. So we add a cancellation token here, and then when I press space, we suggest parameter names for you now in IntelliSense. And that's coming in the new Visual Studio 2017 update. So we're working very hard to try and add features into the product from the tooling side that are the sorts of things that, you know, are in lots of IDEs or in tools that many of us are just installing to augment their experience. We want to make sure that at least the best of those, or at least the ones that seem to be, you know, the ones your fingertips, you know, you feel like you really need, are in the product right out of the box. So we're adding this in, you know, suggestions for parameter names. So I can just press tab and accept that. And, you know, usually you make cancellation tokens. Often you make them this optional cancellation. But that's a really great place, again, to use a default literal expression. So because, again, this is a target type situation, so I don't need that redundancy. What's going on there? Okay, let's undo back out of this. We'll watch the power of the Visual Studio undo stack. Interestingly, I just undid a package add, which was kind of cool. You're not impressed, I can tell. I can redo it. All right, and I think that's back where we started before we went off into the weeds there. All right, let's get rid of customer. Okay, next, I want to talk about deconstruction because you know, we're using a tuple up here. We're dotting into it. We're getting the sum out. But often I don't want to do that. Often I just want to get a value out of a tuple, or I don't talk about the tuple itself. I want to just get the values out immediately into variables that I can use. And we have that. We have support for that. It's a feature called deconstruction, where instead of saying assign the tuple into the variable t, I could just say deconstruct that tuple into the two variables, sum and count. Right? And then I can come down here and replace this with sum. Okay. And so this is, again, there's a pattern here underneath in the language that we're doing, sort of like what we do with link, where there is a method, if there's an instance method or an extension method, something that syntactically we can find there called deconstruct, we'll use it to actually do this deconstruction. Basically, the deconstruct method is a method that returns void and a bunch of out parameters with the deconstruction. So there can be multiple overloads of these to do interesting things. So you can add them to your own types, you can add them to other types with extension methods. But for tuples, right, it's just to get the values out. Now, it's a little weird here that I'm getting out sum and count because I don't actually use count. And so for that, I just discard it. Okay, so I don't care about that value, right? I'm deconstructing, but I only want sum. Okay. And so this is actually a new feature. It's a small feature in C# 7 to be able to discard these things. The idea here, if I have multiple, you know, fields in this, multiple members in the tuple that I don't care about, right? I can just discard them all, just with an underscore. It's sort of like what we see people do with lambda expressions when they don't actually care about the variables, the parameters that were passed in, and just specify an underscore, because that's actually a valid identifier in C#, just a single underscore. And so we've for new features, we're taking this and turning it into the discard, and eventually we hope to do that for lambda expressions as well, where the parameter list can become just underscores for the ones I don't care about. We have to do it in a non-breaking way, which is tricky. Okay. Now, also with deconstruction, I don't have to declare int. I can use var here. And if I had count as well, I could use var there too. But there's a special form of deconstruction that allows, if you're just doing var for all of them, you can just do it up front. Right. This is one of the syntaxes when we came to the language design team, said, what are the syntaxes? What do you want to write? What's code you want to write to use with tuples? Right. And I was like, well, I want to write var x, y equals get point. That's what I want to be able to write. Let's make sure that's a goal. And so that's in the language as well. And of course we can discard this bit. Okay, so another new language feature. Let's go back to let's go back into Tally. We're gonna do some more implementation. I want to actually add a local function. Local functions are kind of the sleeper hit for me in C# 7. In C# 6, the sleeper hit was expression-bodied members. I never thought I cared until I used them. I was like, oh my gosh, it's great. You know, and watched like hundreds of lines of code just shrink as I took away all the braces and everything. It was beautiful. Local functions are maybe not as awesome as that for me, but they're a sleeper hit in the sense that I didn't expect to like them as much as I did. So I wanted to have some logic here and on how I'm going to actually update R, the tuple here. So we're going to just write a function in line, okay? Different from a lambda expression, there's no delegate capturing or anything happening here. You can capture variables, but it's things happen quite a bit differently under the hood. So, I need to assign R to R.S plus S, because I'm passing in S and C, and R.C plus C. So, yes, I'm using two of my sleeper hits here. I've got a local function, and I've got an expression body member, all in line. All right, so we can take that, and we can call add with S, or sorry, V and 1. And when we first introduced this, we made them lexically scoped, which means that basically like it couldn't be used until it was declared, right? Sort of like local variables are. You can't use the variable X until you actually declare it somewhere, right? And so that's how we wrote this. And then we got really strong feedback actually from Kathleen Dollard was the one that gave it first, said, you guys are nuts. And she's doing a C# talk tomorrow as well, so go see that. She's got a really great perspective on this. The idea that I have to, you know, I'm kind of forced to put my local functions into places in my code, felt a little funky. I should be able to put them anywhere, right? It doesn't matter that they're used before or after they're declared. We can just put them anywhere. And so I can push this all the way down here, right where kind of a helper method should go off to the side, and that works really nicely. Okay, so local functions, they're beautiful and they work really well. So, all right, we're gonna get a little silly now. For my next features, I'm gonna get a little bit even more contrived than this demo is already. So instead of having an integer array of numbers, we're gonna have an object array, and then we're gonna do some wacky stuff. Let's make sure that this doesn't have to be just numbers. We can have a nested array inside it. We could also, you know, we could pass in null, strings, you know, just more types of data in here, okay? Now, of course, calling tally is going to have an error because this needs to be an object array. And then we get down here, and we have errors. Whoops, because I did that. But we have errors because V is now an object, and add takes an int, and, well, okay, so the code we always write for this looks like this, right? If V is int, then we're gonna say, let me put this up here, and we will create a new variable called I, and we'll cast V to an int and pass it in there, right? That's what we usually write. And you know, you see this all over the place in code today. But with C# 7, there's an easier way to do that. In fact, there's a smudge. It's hard to see. It's under the var I. Telling me that there's things to do. This is, you know, smudge-based programming, right? Smudge-based development. But there's the little dots, and you know, because we're adding fixes to the product to make it easier for you to, you know, migrate your code. You know, sometimes with these language features, sometimes it's just hard to spot where they could be used, right? And so we're doing our best to try and detect them and offer suggestions. And so what it offers for me to do is to use pattern matching here, right? So getting rid of the cast, and instead of just saying if V is int and casting, say if V is int I. And this int I is a new thing. It's a new concept in C#. It's a pattern, okay? It's something that can be, the expression on the left can be matched against, and then it can also declare variables that pull structure out of that, that expression on the left. So in this case, it's a simple type pattern. Int I is a type pattern. You're gonna see these show up around the language more and more. As we start exploring this, because in functional programming languages like F#, there are tons of different patterns. It's a kind of a core concept of the language and how you write code, right? In this very pattern sort of way, And so in C sharp, we don't have nearly as many patterns. The type pattern is one. We also have constant patterns. So I could write, for example, I could write null here, if v is null, or I could, you know, any sort of literal, I could make it, like if it's 42, that's legal now. And if v was actually a float and it was 42.0, it's still safe. Yeah, it would still be true. So there's interesting things here. Now, I've got a bunch of types, though, that I need to pass in. So I could do a lot of else ifs, right, which is a lot of fun. Everybody likes that, right? No. I need to match on all these other types. I've got strings, and I've got this other object array. I could just use the language construct we have for kind of switching on some value coming in. And I'll use a switch statement. And so we've, in C Sharp 7, we've greatly expanded switch, so that now it, switch used to be, well, let's put it this way. Switch used to take constant expressions. Now the way we look at switch and what it was before, now we just say, you know, switch was always pattern-based. It's just that it took constant patterns before. And now we're just going to expand that into the other patterns. And so I can use a type pattern here with int I, right, and do the same thing. And now I can come in and start writing my other cases where I say, okay, let's get the object array, right? And the object array makes sense that we would do this in kind of terms of, you know, going recursively with our tally function already. So I'll go ahead and deconstruct calling tally with that object array, okay? And then I can add those in. We can break, right? That's kind of nice. Now, of course, the engineer in me, right, says, well, that's kind of inefficient. There's a case I shouldn't even be bothering with. Right? What if the length is equal to zero? I don't even want to do that. So I can express that as well. And so I could write a when clause in here. Ooh. Right? But now, of course, there is the case when the length is zero. So I got to handle that as well. So I'll add another case for object. But I actually don't want to do anything with it, so I'll just discard it. No problem. There's also the case that null might be passed in, so we'll just skip out of that. And then I want a default case, as always, to catch anything I didn't care about before. Say, not numbers, and we'll be good citizens in passing the name of the parameter. Okay. So, interestingly, the default case is not widely known, but in switch statements, it can actually go anywhere. It doesn't need to be at the end. Most people, 99.9% of the time, put it at the end, but it's totally legal there. So for compat, we allow it to be anywhere in these switch statements as well. But when it executes, it will always execute last. Okay, so even if I have it way up above, because it's kind of the catch-all for patterns that didn't match, right? And this is where it lands, so it will always be last. Okay. We have one more to check, though. We have string. I'm passing in 42 as a string up there. We have one more to do. And so let's do that case string right now. So I'm going to say case string s. I need to get the number out of it. So I can use int.tryParse. Okay. And pass in my string, and well, now I've got an out variable. So I'll go ahead and do this. So I'm going to declare my variable. I got to declare it outside the switch because that's fun, right? All the way up there, and then we can finish things up. Inside here. Whoops. I.1. But of course, also there's the problem that I now conflicts with this I. You know, the language is just not helping me out today. But there's a smudge to the rescue, right? The smudge underneath int I. And those little dots are telling me about a new C-sharp 7 feature. This is, by and large, my favorite, which is out variables, right? So the ability to, instead of having to declare my variable somewhere earlier in my program so that I can use it in the out position, I can just inline that variable in there, and see it goes all the way inside down to the try parse call. And so now there's a new I in scope here that doesn't conflict with the I above, right? Those are in completely different scopes, so I can reuse the variable names here, right? And so this is a tremendously useful feature, also because it lets me use these variables in places I never could before, in case, you know, sections like this and switch sections, in constructor initializers. There's all sorts of interesting places where I can use these, and so that's pretty cool. Cool. What do you guys think? C# 7, it's good. C# 7.1 seems like it's, you know, it's going to be okay. It's a nice little boost to existing things. Really, there's only just the three features there. There's a couple of others that I wouldn't even be able to demo because they're more like bug fixes. They're things that I hope you didn't stub your toe on before, and you know and you shouldn't anymore. Well, that's a good start. That's C# 7, but we've got more to talk about because there's a project down here called Secret Demo, and I've had it there very tantalizing for you guys. Let me see. Gut branch. That's probably not what I want. Nah. So, I'm in the wrong folder. Sorry. Moving. Yeah, this was my language demo. Let's roll this back. So now we're back, and you know, all this code, all of our beautiful code is all gone. Sorry. I know, it was meaningful. It was our time together. And I'll get rid of the file we added, the packages config. And now let's take a look here. I've got another branch called Super Secret Demo. Yes. Let's head over to that. Okay. Yes, reload me. You're done. Get out of here. There's the program back again. Okay, so Secret Demo. Now, this is where we're getting into places where I'm showing stuff. Now, I want to be clear that I have two sets of bits on this machine. There are two shortcuts here. There's one that's called medium hot VS bits, and one that's called super hot VS bits, okay? The medium hot VS bits, this is what we've been looking at. It's not exactly what we gave out at build because it has the C# 7.1 features in it that didn't make it, right? And the super hot bits I built myself. So hopefully there's no crashes. We'll see. So the feature I want to look at right now is around, well, let's just look at this program. So I've got an interface, I1, with a method, M1. And then I've got a class, C1, that implements I1 and just prints C1.M1 to the console. And then in the program itself just simply conses up C1, creates an instance of C1, implicitly converts it to the I1, and then through that interface, right, it calls M1. So right here, it creates it in a variable of type I1 and then calls M1 through there. Okay, and so if I run this, I'll just control F5 so we can see the output after it builds. And it prints as we expect. Now, we're going to start with kind of a mind-blowing thing, and then we'll dig into why I might want to do this. Okay, so bear with me. The mind blow is that this is just kind of very simple, doesn't really have any need to have any state. Can I just put it there and give the body inside the interface itself, right? And with this prototype, the answer is yes, I can, because there's no squiggles, right? That means everything's good, as far as I know. That's what my compiler tells me. So I'm going to actually debug into this because I'm crazy debugging with a prototype. Who knows if this stuff works? Interestingly, if you can see very carefully at the very, very top of that console, it's like secret sauce / core run.exe, because I'm using a custom runtime for this as well. So debugging a custom runtime with Visual Studio Debugger that doesn't know anything about it, we'll see. So a step in, hey, it got there. That's pretty cool, right? We're actually stepping through code that's now defined in the interface itself and not in the class. I can actually test fate. And we'll edit and continue, see if that works. Did it work? Let's see the program. Oh yeah, totally worked. So well, this is a prototype of a feature right now that we're calling default interface implementation, which is a very general name that you know, it took some feedback at build that seems like it's not clear why you might want to do this, right? It seems like, well, thanks, you just obfuscated my code for me. That's great. And it's more than a code obfuscation feature. The idea, if you want to think about interfaces as contracts, that you know, you want implementers to adhere to. We're enhancing that. A way to think of this feature is enhancing those contracts with the idea of that I can have members that are optional, right? So I can have a member that, as part of my contract, I could implement it optionally, and if I don't, there's a default implementation there that would be used instead. Okay, so this would allow me to also, by way of kind of, you know, a side effect of this, is that I can potentially add members to interfaces so long as I add default implementations to them that are non-breaking, right? That don't break the implementers. So consider this example. I've got like an iLogger interface here and a couple of implementers, right? Now, suppose I want to go and change that interface. Maybe I want to go and add another log method that takes an exception, right? And you know, just for a helper, right? And so I come in, I could do this right here, and it breaks all the implementers down below, right? And so what people usually do is they'll create an extension method on iLogger, right, that takes an exception and keeps that in the same namespace so that you have these other methods that are helper methods that you can use with it, and, instead of doing it like I'm doing it right now, which is just implementing in terms of the other log method, passing toString, you would have this as an extension method. But the reason why this is more powerful than that is that now the implementers can optionally go and add a specialization for that, which I couldn't do with an extension method, right? So the idea that I could come down here and say, well, I want to, you know, maybe my console logger doesn't care about changing the implementation of that. That is fine with the default but the telemetry logger might want to do something more. It might want to come down and say, no, I am going to implement this method because I want to capture a stack, like a crash dump or something, right? So it wants to do something extra special. And so I can specialize these. So that's the idea, okay? There's other reasons that we're digging into this. First of all, as you know, optional interface members look an awful lot like, if you're familiar with iOS development, like protocols in Objective-C, where I can have optional members, right? And also, this is very heavily influenced by default interface implementation as a feature in Java, right? Now, it turns out that writing C# code for iOS and Android is a thing, and it becomes more difficult, and there's more of an impedance mismatch with C# on iOS development against protocols when they have optional members. You kind of have to go through some extra hoops to make that work. And then now the default interface implementation is in Java, now that's going to show up more and more, and it's already showing up in the Android API, right? And so we want to have a great way for C# to kind of interface with these, if you excuse the pun, as well. And so that's kind of the reason we're taking a look at this, a bigger reason why we're taking a look at this. We've always kind of thought this would be a cool feature, but hey, it requires runtime changes, and that's expensive. But also in our new world of having a lightweight .NET Core with Core CLR that you can deploy yourself, there's a world where maybe C# features come on in more of a staggered fashion if they need runtime support, and you can take the runtime with you until it's on .NET Framework or on Mono. So that's the idea here. Does it make sense? Because I confused a lot of people at Build. Okay, it makes sense. Thank you. So one other feature I want to show, C# 8 kind of time frame and these kind of major features. Not a promise it's going to be in C# 8 or that there will be a C# 8. I have to say those things. But these are things we're looking at very heavily. And this is one that we've actually talked about a number of times and with where people have requested a number of times, people have had proposals. For a feature called non-nullable reference types. Has anybody heard of this this idea? So that you can have, I want to be able to say, like, add an exclamation point or something to my type to say, this can never be null and ensure that it never is, right? And guarantee that for me and add some null guarantees to my programs. It turns out that problem is super hard, right? It requires, again, runtime changes. There was a little known thing called the halting problem that proved that it's actually impossible to do it completely. But you know, with the runtime, you can do better. But it's also very, very expensive and costly to do at runtime. So we've gone kind of back and forth in this feature. We've thought about it in a number of different ways. And while we were kind of navel-gazing, contemplating our navels, in design meetings, thinking about non-nullable reference types, other languages came out with features like this, but from a different angle. Right? Instead of saying, well, we're going to make the entire world non-nullable, we're going to let you state when you want various reference types to be non-nullable. God, so many double negatives, right? Instead of doing that, how about a compiler switch that just assumes everything is non-nullable and then gives you an annotation to say, to state your intent when things can be null? Okay, Swift has done this, TypeScript's done this, and instead of going kind of, you know, throughout the entire breadth of the program and doing full program analysis and making sure it's always accurate, instead offering flow analysis that gives you editor detection while you're typing in your code, right? So you can decide whether where it can tell you, hey, this might be null, you might want to deal with it right now. And so the idea is, instead of guaranteeing that your program won't have null reference exceptions, making sure you type fewer of them, right, as you're writing your code. So I've got a prototype here. Now this is just gathering up some text. Let's change the name of this to text from some source somewhere, and then we're going to call a method that counts the lines in this text that have a particular character in them. Okay, and so we're going to call text with the literal x, and right away I have a squiggle on text, and it's telling me that there's a possible null reference here. The reason for that is because this database load text method says that string that it's returned here, it's got a question mark on it, like a nullable value type. Now it can be, we could say that this reference type can be null because I've turned on a compiler flag in this prototype that says everything's non-null, assume everything's non-null, and I'll let you know when things can be null. This says it can be null, but down here, count lines with char doesn't have that annotation, so it assumes, well, it can't be null. Therefore, there's a conflict, there's a possibility of a null reference here. So we could add a check, right? If text equals null, the other way around, right? That's why we need this feature. And now the squiggle goes away, right? Because now that I've checked for null, the flow analysis knows, well, okay, at this point it can't be null, so we can go ahead and pass this in safely. All right? That's the idea. I could also do it differently, and I could instead say, well, I don't want to do that in all my calling code. That seems silly. I want to put that in the method itself. And so at the method, I could say, okay, this particular value can be null. And then we get a squiggle down here of a possible dereference, right? Because split cannot be called on null. So therefore, this is a possible dereference. And so I can come up here and put the check here. Well, if it's null, then there's no line, so we just return zero. And we're good, and the warnings go away, right? And so that's the approach we're taking with this. Right now it's kind of in the C# 8 bucket, but it kind of comes as more of a very, very, very smart analyzer that does enough flow analysis to give good, positive results. It's not going to catch everything, right? Again, Turing proved that we couldn't. With a halting problem. But so it's not going to catch everything, and it's not going to do, you know, massive interprocedural analysis, but it's going to flag the easy mistakes that you're going to make that everybody's making all the time, and then they have five and they see the null reference and they're like, ugh, right? It'd be great if the editor helped me not write that in the first place, right? And so we're calling this nullable reference types, not non-nullable reference types. Oh, three negatives. Okay. All right. We are almost out of time, so I'm going to switch back to slides. And we've been through this. A couple of other C# 8 features that I don't have prototypes for. Again, these are not guaranteed. There are things we're talking about. Async streams. So yeah, as I said, C# was a front runner in getting async into kind of mainstream programming. And so with other languages kind of taking that up and adding async support, they've also tended to, they've gone a little bit further than we have. And like, we're actually getting a little bit behind now in async and C#. And so the ability where you have a stream that returns data asynchronously and being able to for each over that in a way where the language gives you good syntax support, along with framework types like iasync enumerable and those sorts of things, which you would not believe the arguments you get into about how that should be written. It's amazing. In the language design, but also things that maybe have resources that require being disposed in an asynchronous fashion, right? And being able to wait on those. So that's something we're talking about. Another one we're talking about, extension everything, which we talk about every release. And we've had numerous ideas and prototypes and proposals of this, but the idea that, you know, I've got extension methods, could I add all the other things as extensions as well, to the point that I can no longer look at a program and tell what it does, right? Because, I mean, you get in extension operators and all of that, and, you know, Who knows? We'll see. This is one we continue to look at. There's a really interesting proposal in the C# language repo called, I want to say it's called extensions and shapes, that's gotten a lot of interest. And so this is one we're continuing to talk about, and we'll see if it makes it in, if we have great ideas. Records is something that we looked at in C# 7, and we were so close, and we just could not get there. And so it got pulled. But we still want to do this. We still want to do something like this, a way that you can easily write a class in C# that is immutable by default and kind of has all the value semantics, right, just automatically. And that can be easily pattern matched over, right, like records in other languages. And so it would generate all of this goo, right, for you. And so that's something we're also still looking at. So some resources. First, on the language strategy, there's a couple of great blog posts that are linked right there. This will be in the slides that you guys can get. The C# language design happens on GitHub in a repo called C# Lang. If you feel intimidated when you get there because it seems like there's a lot of smart people there and you don't feel as smart, I feel the same way, okay? There's a lot of really smart people on there. It's okay. If you're passionate about a language feature or about the language, add your voice. It's awesome. And that's where Roslyn is. Roslyn is the C# VB compilers and IDE stack, and that's where we are on GitHub. So anyways, thank you very much, guys. I think we're out of time. I'll be around afterwards if anybody wants to come up and chat, ask any questions. So thanks.